Okay, good afternoon, everybody. I think we're ready to start. Welcome. It's a pleasure to join together once again with Kedma and for one of our interviews with leading figures in Israel. Kedma, of course, a youth organization based in Israel, working primarily with a lot of the American kids who are there for their year or two or more in Israel. And it's a pleasure to work with them. And I'll just let them run with the show, and I'll introduce Orit, who will introduce our program. Thank you very much.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much, Rabbi Kalman. My name is Orit Seif. I'm the director of Kedma. Along with our co-sponsors, Torah in Motion, JIC, the Lachaim Center, and Alinu, I would like to welcome you all to a special summer edition of Kedma Conversations. I would like to especially thank Torah in Motion for making this platform available to us. As many of you know, Kedma has created volunteer initiatives worldwide for nearly 25 years. And in Israel, one of our main focuses is our work with gap year students. Over this past year, notwithstanding the many challenges posed by the coronavirus, our students volunteered pretty much straight from September through June through a combination of both corona-safe in-person and remote volunteering. The importance of volunteering has become more prominent during the pandemic and has led us at Kedma to launch our newest program called Marking Milestones. Through Marking Milestones, we want to work with you to elevate your simcha by integrating volunteering into your milestone celebration. We are taking the robust network of Israeli nonprofits that we created for our gap year programming and are connecting those causes to families and individuals who want volunteering, either in person or remote, to be a part of their celebration. Kedma's response to the challenges brought upon by the coronavirus is to meet them head on by creating volunteer initiatives that benefit Israeli society for students, professionals, individuals, and families in Israel and abroad. Since 2016, but especially over the last year and a half, as editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post, today's guest, Yaakov Katz, has written extensively about the constantly shifting landscape of Israeli politics, coronavirus regulations, and Israeli society on the whole. Prior to becoming editor-in-chief, Yaakov was a senior foreign policy advisor to then Minister of Education and Diaspora Affairs, Naftali Bennett, and is also a noted author. Yaakov, thank you so much for joining us today. It is now my pleasure to introduce Kedma's founder and chairman, Mori Kalman.
Thank you very much, Orit. It's a real pleasure to be here today with all of you, but especially with Yaakov, because on a very personal level, I have to give hakara tatov to Yaakov. I dove in his corona minion for many, many months, that they're through thick and thin, beginning last fall until, like I said, many months. Beautiful minion. Great children. I have to thank Yaakov and his wife for that. Their kids had a great time playing with his kids. And Bezrat Hashem, we'll daven together, whether corona or not. So it's it's wonderful to see you, Yaakov. And we'll get right into it right now. So I want to begin our first question just because you are in a very illustrious position in the, as we know, the Jerusalem Post, even though it's a relatively smaller circulation, Israel is not a huge country. There's a smaller English-speaking population, really punches above its weight, has a tremendous influence around, not only in Israel, but really around the world. And I want to ask you just if you can give us a little insight into your journey to the Post as editor of the Post, how you got from there. I believe you're probably the first observant Jew, I think, editor, in the history of the Post also to be the editor. So if you can just walk us through a little bit how you went from growing up in Chicago, I believe, to this really illustrious position.
Well, first of all, it's great to be with you all, Rabbi Kalman, both Rabbi Kalman and Orit, good to see you as well. It's nice to join all of you from Jerusalem. Mari, we miss you. We miss the minion, but maybe, I don't know, with the situation right now with corona here in Israel, we might be renewing it come the Chagim. Everyone's talking about a possible lockdown again, starting around the Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot. So, who knows? But my journey, I guess, in 1993, my family, my parents told my older brother and I, were four boys, that we are going to Israel for a year. And a year for me turned into now just marked July. I think we arrived on July 22nd. So 1 year became for me 28 years. And still going strong. I've had a couple of breaks in the middle in the States, a couple of year here, a year there. But But that was, and that became quite apparent shortly after we arrived here. I could see that my mother had was really taken in and was not going back. Journalism, though, I did high school. After high school, I went to yeshiva. I did the Hesder program in Alon Shvut at Yeshivat Har Etzion. Orit's husband was a couple years ahead of me, but I got to know him there, Rabbi Yehuda Seif. And I was, after I finished my army service and being in yeshiva, I met my wife-to-be, and she was doing her law internship in an office in Tel Aviv, and I had been accepted to Bar Ilan Law School. But I had about 8-9 months before law school was starting from when I was ending yeshiva and I was going to be starting law school, and I needed to find something to do. My wife was a little nervous that I would be bored and not have anything to keep me busy. And she said, you know, you like news, you like writing. Why don't you try to get a job in journalism? And I had never, I did like writing, but I never wrote news. I liked following current events, but nothing beyond that. And I said, I wouldn't even know how to get my foot in the door. But then I remembered that I had coached Little League Baseball. I have two brothers who are about 10 years younger than I am. And, you know, in the times, unfortunately, the Israel baseball team is not progressing the way we might have hoped.
At difficult the day for Israel today.
Yeah, difficult day for Israel. Although to be defeated by, was the Dominican Republic, you know, I think they are a bigger baseball a powerhouse than the state of Israel, right? You look at some of the players who make it to the major leagues, more from the Dominican Republic than from Jerusalem. But I coached on my Little League baseball team as a kid whose father was a former journalist at the Jerusalem Post. And I called him up and he put in a good word for me, not actually at the Jerusalem Post, but at Haaretz newspaper. And I went to meet with their editor of their English website. And that was my first job. I worked there for about a year. And then I started law school in the middle. And I was in my first year in law school. I had just gotten married. I was working crazy hours. I was doing the shift work, like grunt shift work on the desk of the website. It was becoming all too much for me. So I actually quit Haaretz. And because I was going to be a lawyer. I was going to make a lot of money. I was going to go into corporate law. That was my plan. That was my trajectory. And shortly, a few months later, I realized why I had made the mistake of my life. I hate law school. I don't want to be a lawyer. I miss journalism. And you know, this was 2002. This was the height of the Second Intifada. It was a very difficult time, but the news was insane, right? There were terrorist attacks all the time, bus bombing, shooting attacks. This was Ariel Sharon was prime minister, Operation Defensive Shield, if you recall, when the IDF went back into the West Bank and retook all of the Palestinian cities that it had transferred security control over to the Palestinian Authority just a couple of years earlier, retook them in a massive, large-scale operation. So the news was fascinating at the time, and to be part of that was amazing. But I felt it was too much, and I walked away from it, but I missed it. And I couldn't go back to Haaretz, so I applied for a job at the Jerusalem Post. And I really say to my employees today, I started in what was really seen as the bottom of the ladder, the bottom of the totem pole. I was a update editor on the internet desk. This is back in 2003 when we did none of our own writing. We just took stories that were sent to us by reporters or from the Associated Press or Reuters and put them online. And I climbed the ladder. And I use myself as an example to my staff of, if you have drive, ambition, if you're passionate about something, if you love it, if you live it, breathe it, live it, you know, and die for it, you can succeed, right? It's not some raw talent that Yaakov Katz was born with. I did not know how to write news. I learned, I practiced, I studied, I later in my career, I was accepted to a mid-career fellowship at Harvard University for journalists. And while I was there, I took two amazing writing workshops, one in fiction writing, one in nonfiction writing. And I see how much that improved my writing. I mean, I can't, till today I learn, right? And I think that like many things in life, if you're passionate about something, if you love it, if you're willing to invest the time to work at it, still today I'm editor-in-chief and I still work. I still learn. I'm still improving, I think. You can really achieve amazing things. So that's my story.
Thank you. Okay, by the way, for those of us from Toronto also, you should know that it was Jose Bautista, who was a big Blue Jay star, who defeated Israel. He knocked in the winning run to in the ninth inning. So, all right, the difficult day, like we said, but there's always 2028, and next time baseball will be in the Olympics. And we'll have two hopefully observant players maybe by then also. That's for another time. Okay, so I want to turn a little bit just to the
By the way, if I could just say, you know, I just want to say one thing. Yeah. The role, you know, just you mentioned observant. We'll get to that. Okay, so
I want to talk a little about Jewish versus Israeli paper. Exactly. We can maybe expand upon that then. Yeah. But I want to turn a little bit just to the craft of journalism. We all know that obviously with the rise of the internet, journalism has changed tremendously. It's facing unimaginable challenges from 20, 30 years ago, papers closing all the time. So I want to just ask you a little bit about the state of journalism today. One of the criticisms of journalism has been, especially in some of the larger papers, that journalism has on and papers in general have moved a little bit from reporting to advocacy. So I wanted you to talk about that a little bit and also how you craft editorial policy. We've seen the Jerusalem Post over the years go from left to right all over the place. So if you can talk, give us a little inside view of when you came on and to this day, how do you craft that policy? What is it you with the team, you know, you're owned by Ma'ariv, I believe now, correct? Like how much input do they have into editorial policy? How much freedom is there for you individually and for your staff, your editorial staff?
So there's a lot to unpack there. I'll try. First of all, I decide everything. I wake up in the morning and I know, I'm kidding. we're not owned by Ma'ariv. We're owned by the same person who owns us, owns also Ma'ariv, also owns a big website in Israel called Walla, owns a couple of radio stations. He's something of a large media businessman at the moment, and is really one of the, I would say, the leading media owners today in the state of Israel. The Jerusalem Post and Haaretz newspaper are the two papers that every single day write an editorial. Okay, so that's 6 days a week that we publish not only, of course, the news and opinions from columnists and guest writers, but we also publish our own editorial, and that's a position that we take as a newspaper. We craft that, that's basically me together with one or two other senior editors, together with the person who's going to be writing it that day. I have a team of top editors, and every day we have someone else who writes that editorial. It's not, no secret that in newspapers, it's not always the editor-in-chief who writes it. But it's definitely, I go through the idea with whoever is writing it, and we bounce off the ideas with some other people, and we decide what we're going to do. But I would say that big gadol, like in the big picture, We abide by a number of key, I would say, kind of guidelines or ideologies maybe that guide us. You know, first of all, people don't believe me, and I don't know that you necessarily will either. The owner of the newspaper never interferes, never intervenes. And that's a rare commodity today. It's rare at all because we just see how politicized journalism has become, how much it's used as a weapon or as an agenda or as a tool to advance a political or a business agenda by whoever might own it. We see that definitely in Israel, where you have one newspaper that's owned by now the widow of Sheldon Adelson, but Miriam Adelson, what this is called, Yisrael Hayom, which is a newspaper that was established with the declared objective of helping Benjamin Netanyahu and still today is very much in his favor. We have a newspaper called Yediot Achronot, which is a Hebrew newspaper, which is very anti Netanyahu. And the owner of that paper is even embroiled in one of the corruption cases that have been brought against the prime minister. And he's on trial as well for bribery in that case. But my owner never gets involved. And I look at that as a bracha, as a blessing. It's really it's rare and it's a great thing. But what we do is we believe in a number of key principles. Principle number one is we believe in a strong Israel. We believe in a safe and secure Israel. Yes, we do also believe in a two-state solution. That is something that has long been the objective of the key principles of the Jerusalem Post. And we also are strong advocates of pluralism in Israel, and to the extent even of a separation of religion and state in Israel, right? More from the objective of opening up religion to more people in this country. Religion has sadly in Israel become highly politicized. I don't know if you all are aware or have read, but Artyom Dolgoyov, I'm probably not pronouncing his name correctly, is the new hero for the state of Israel, is a gymnast who won the gold medal a couple of days ago, is not halakhically Jewish, right? He is, his father is Jewish, his mother is not Jewish, and he made Aliyah from Ukraine a number of years ago under the law of return, because with one parent who's Jewish, you're allowed to be here. We have about 300,000 Israelis who are like this, and they have no way of getting married in the state of Israel. And you can only get married in Israel through a religious institution, whether it's the rabbinate if you're Jewish, the church if you're Christian, or the Islamic courts if you're Muslim. But someone like him, who is our hero today, does not have a right to get married. And that's a problem. That's a problem in a democracy. It's a problem when we have so many Jews around the world who are turning away from Israel because they feel that Israel discriminates against them, does not recognize their Jewishness. I would like to see a state of Israel that's more open to that. And that's something that we do. We write about that a lot. We write about that also because we look at ourselves as the Jerusalem Post, as a newspaper that not only, we're not a local Israeli newspaper in the traditional sense. Yes, we publish a paper every single day, but we look at ourselves as a voice for the Jews of the world to advance and represent them in Israel, but also to represent Israel among them. And that's why we take on issues that most media outlets in this country would never even talk about, right? Like what's going to be with the Kotel? What's going to be with conversion? What's going to be with the kashrut reforms that are taking place? Religion, I have a religious affairs reporter. You don't see that among many newspapers. I have a diaspora affairs reporter. It's just us, I think, and one other newspaper. We believe strongly in these issues. And I believe that the Jerusalem Post is at the center of all of that. So that is what we do. And listen, journalism today is a tough business. You know, just to the first part of your question, the state of journalism is complicated. Everyone's talking about new business models and how to survive and how do you make money? And we're constantly thinking about these things. And Corona, even to an extent, showed the urgency of how much, from my perspective as an editor, I've been now just over 5 years until Corona was kind of smooth sailing. Corona comes along and you see how like that, your whole business model could go down the drain and you could lose a newspaper, right? And you have to also think of the business side and you can't ignore that. But we also have to hold by principles which we believe in, because otherwise what's our identity? And I think that, you know, there's a delicate balance here that needs to be weighed and played all the time within this business.
Okay, so to follow up on that and to get to the comment that I think you were going to make, so you mentioned that you see the role of the Jerusalem Post as really representing world Jewry, being a voice for the way beyond Israel. So how do you define yourself, though, in terms of being an Israeli versus a Jewish paper? And you mentioned we have religious affairs, and Jeremy Sharon, right, I think, right, writes always about religion, etc. So do you define yourself really more as an Israeli paper, a Jewish paper? And the question of, you know, I don't want to get personal in terms of your observance, et cetera, but how does that play a role? And if you find that stories are going to be very negative about Judaism, how do you, walk around some of those perhaps landmines as well?
So, you know, my job is not to, I am not an arm of the state of Israel. Right, I am not a unit within the IDF spokesman's office. Right, we are an independent news organization whose job, by the way, is, I very much believe, to be a watchdog for democracy, and to hold the government of this country accountable, the political leaders of this country accountable, with the objective of trying to achieve transparent governance and non-uncorrupt government to make sure that the best decisions are made in the best way possible. And obviously, who are we to decide whether it's the right decision or not, but to always hold a candle to them or a fire to their feet so that they are making the decisions with the right intention and with the interests of the nation at the top of their agenda. Like one of the problems that we had, or I had definitely with ex-Prime Minister Netanyahu, was that for too long, it seemed that his own self-survival and his own personal interests were taking the top priority of his decision-making. And once that starts to happen, then there's something wrong. And he is one of the great leaders that Israel has ever had, but something turned upside down there. And that became a problem, and that became a liability for this country, right? So I believe sincerely that that is our role. I believe that's the role of journalism by large. But I also believe that I have a responsibility to tell the truth and to present an honest and a real picture of Israel, to show the complexity, to show the gray, not the black and white, to show how life here is complicated. It requires nuance. It requires perspective. It requires historical knowledge. It requires education, not ignorance. We will shine a light on stories that the rest of the world will not tell. We will tell stories that can't read in the New York Times or on CNN. And I have no problem going on, during the Gaza war in May, I was every single day almost on CNN. And I saw that as a, not only a responsibility and, as a representative of the Jerusalem Post, but also as an Israeli citizen who lives in this country, the father of four kids, a former soldier who until recently continued to do reserve duty, with rockets being fired into my city and to my country to represent my country. I definitely saw that. I think that a journalist in this country, as opposed to journalists elsewhere, has an identity question that she or he needs to answer. Who am I first? Am I a reporter? Am I a soldier? Am I an Israeli? Am I a Jew? Am I a father? What is my role? And those are questions that I have to ask myself, right? But I also feel that we have a responsibility to hold those in power accountable, and I feel that you mentioned my kippah, but I feel that I have an opportunity, maybe because of who I am and my background and my religious identity, to help maybe bridge between some of these worlds, right? The big advantage, by the way, of being a dati, as an editor of a newspaper, is that I get 24 or 25 hours off every week. I discovered this when I was the military reporter for the Jerusalem Post back in 2006, we're now, just these days, is marking the 15 years since the second Lebanon war. And I would be up north the entire week, and I'd come Shabbat, I'd come back home to Jerusalem. And whether I wanted to or I didn't want to, my phone was off, my computer was off, right? And it was hard. And it was really hard to disconnect because you feel like you have to be engaged. And I won't lie, that was not easy at the time, but I learned afterwards what a blessing it was. If God had not given us Shabbat, someone needed to create Shabbat, because it's such a beautiful idea to pause, to take a step back. And the fact that I have that, and I won't lie, there are some weekends and some Shabbatot that come that it's hard for me. There's news. I know it's happening. It's hard for me to stop come candle lighting on Friday. But I look at it as a bracha, as a blessing, because it gives me the opportunity to pause, to step back, to think about other things, to be with my family, not to be in front of a screen like we all are now. And I look at this as my identity, as someone who cares deeply about Judaism. And I don't know, other people, you don't necessarily have to be religious or observant to care about Judaism, but I do care deeply about Judaism. I care about people loving Judaism. And maybe, you might think that I'm wrong, or other people might think that I'm wrong, but I want people to love Judaism too, the way I do. So when I see discrimination against other people in this country because they're not Jewish enough, or I see that Jews around the world feel that they don't have a place in this country because they're reformed, they're conservative, whatever it might be, that pains me personally. I want people to connect to this country the way I do. I want them to love the country the way I do. I want them to love Judaism the way I do, right? And I feel that we've politicized our religion too much. So there's work that can be done.
Okay, thank you for that. Just there are a number of questions. We'll hopefully get to those towards the end, so you can keep them coming, but we won't answer them right now. To pick up a little bit about that in terms of not everybody likes your positions, you get your credit and the paper's credit. You publish a lot of critical letters from the left, from the right, from all over the place. How do you deal on a personal level, even just with criticism? Has it gotten out of hand? Have you gotten any letters or other things that sometimes can be a little threatening? And, because that's obviously the nature of taking a stand, is that not everybody's going to like it, especially when we're talking about such fiery issues.
I mean, you get criticism. That's fine. I enjoy it also. I think that part of what our job as a newspaper is to stir the pot, to create a conversation, to create a little controversy, to get people thinking. I think that too often we live in an echo chamber, all of us, right? It's so comfortable and convenient to just hear what we already believe and to reinforce what we already are thinking. But it's more difficult to be challenged and to have to really think about it. But by the way, when you are challenged, when you reach that conclusion that you reach, that means you're reaching even a better conclusion because you've thought about it, you've been challenged, and you've still reached a conclusion. I think that's a good thing, right? I think that's part of the job of a newspaper. If we just tell you the same thing over and over again, what are we doing? And I think that's why we have to provide perspective from across the spectrum. So I don't mind the criticism. You know, sometimes it gets personal. Sometimes people will write, will call you a Nazi or, you know, things along those lines. You know, okay, there's always going to be people like that. It's funny, I actually have this one person who I don't know who it is because, you know, you can write anonymous letters who constantly writes to me, you should go back to West Rogers Park in Chicago, back to 2E Avenue. So, you know, it's clearly someone who knows. I used to live just off of 2E on a small side street called Fitch. So, you know, that was my stomping ground, as a kid. So clearly someone who knows me, who knows where I grew up. I would love to just know who that is. But you're not going to, I guess.
Okay. Yeah. Anybody here? Any from? All right. All right. So I wanted just to turn to an issue, which in terms of how you interview and get stories from politicians, sort of pick up on that a little bit as well. When you're critical, of certain politicians, do they sometimes cut you off? How do you deal with that? And getting an inside view of politicians that you're dealing with, you know, especially those that you might be critical of. And also if there are differences between the public and private personas of these people, like do they sometimes anonymously or not anonymously, quietly tell you different things? That they take certain stands in the public that don't necessarily reflect who they are?
So it's two parts. You know, the first is, and this I tell my reporters all the time, they need us more than we need them. And it's so true, right? Sometimes we forget that, right? We so want that interview. We so want, the story. So we think it's, you know, you got to be careful what you're going to write, or you know, if they don't take our call or they don't answer or we can't get through to the spokesperson, whoever it is. But at the end of the day, they need us more than we need them. And it just always proves itself, right? They of course don't want criticism. They of course only want positive articles. So there are ways to get their attention. There are ways to get to them. And I've never encountered difficulty in reaching someone for an interview. Of course, there are going to be people who aren't going to want to speak to us, right? You know, Netanyahu is an example of someone who, after we took a quite critical stance, especially after the indictment was filed against him and his trial began, where we thought it no longer made sense that a prime minister on trial can stay prime minister, he would no longer speak to us. And that's fine. We live with that. You know, that's the price we will pay for our position that we took, that we believe to be the right moral position for what the state of Israel should have. How are these people in person? Not very different from the way they appear in public, right? You know, it depends. I mean, they'll tell you stuff in private that they would never say publicly, right? Like you go sit with Likud members today, and I sit with many of them. They will privately criticize Netanyahu in ways you would never imagine, right? But they will, in public, they will only sing his praise, right? In private, they will criticize one another. In public, they would never do that. But, you know, you build up relationships and you build up trust with them, and they'll share this stuff with you. And I think that one of the key characteristics or traits that a good journalist needs is the ability to develop human relationships, right? For people to want to confide in you, right? If you can't, if you're not someone who people will connect to, you're not going to get information. And a lot of this, wait, the commodity that I trade in, okay, so, you know, you could have commodity traders who trade in, I don't know, oil, wheat, whatever it might be, corn, rice, or, you know, copper, or you could have, you know, stock traders. The commodity that I trade in is information and publicity. That's what I can provide people. So it's you learn to leverage what you have to get the information that you sometimes require. It's part of this interesting dynamic that we have. But I'll tell you that at the end of the day, what you also always have to remember as a journalist is that these politicians are not your friend, right? They are, they talk to you not because they like you or because they want to be, you know, they want to hang out with you. I remember once a couple of years ago, I was sitting at dinner or something, and some senior politician wrote me a text message about something. And one of my kids saw and like, wow, Abba, he's your friend? And I said, no, he's not my friend. Not at all is he my friend. He needs me. He needs me. So today he wants to be my friend. Tomorrow, if I'm not in this job, he won't remember who I am. And I think that's always an important thing for us to remember because, you know, we should never let it get to our heads, right? They like us or they talk to us because they need us. And that's part of this dynamic.
Okay. You've written extensively, including, I believe, your editorial a week and a half ago about what you believe is Israel's need to do a much better job dealing with the international media, that you use the issue of the AP building in Gaza, the lack of warning, and many other examples. We've also know that there's an article, I'm blanking on his name right now, another journalist, I think, from Toronto, who wrote in The Atlantic a few years ago describing his whole...
Matti Friedman,
exactly. But basically that there's a whole cadre of international journalists. They feed off one another. They come to Israel. They get the, quote unquote, you know, much more left-wing approach to Israel, anti-Israel. I'm wondering if you could maybe bridge the gap between those. How much more, if Israel was doing a much better job, how much more how much could it counter this?
Right.
And in those issues, that's another important question. Privately, are there differences between what these journalists write about and the general anti-Israel things that are written in the global press versus what they tell you or speak to you privately about and trying to get a better understanding as opposed to just echoing being the echo chamber?
So I'll say a few things. Number one is there is an anti-Israel bias, right? There's no question. I happen to enjoy reading the New York Times. I like their coverage, not of Israel, but about other events that happen in the world, particularly in the United States. They have this great puzzle that if you want to check it out, it's like the spelling bee. You got to make these words. It's a good mind exercise. I enjoy that. But they're obsessed with Israel, obsessed. I mean, the amount they write about this country. I've no doubt that there is that bias, but to your question of would it even help, right, if we did better as a state or as a country to fight that bias? So here's my answer. I don't know. You know why? Because we've never tried, right? We've never done what we could potentially do. So it's very easy to say they're anti-Israel, they're anti-Semites, and just write them all off. That's the easiest, most convenient thing to do. And that's what a majority of people in this country do. It's not worth trying because it won't do anything, right? They're all against us. And we've had political leaders, by the way, who have pushed that narrative also because it was convenient for them politically to make it seem as if everybody's against us and then you need a certain leader to be able to defend you and to protect you, right? But what I say is, why are we not trying to do the best that we can do? Why is no one sitting around the table? You spoke about the AP building and saying, hold on a second. We're about to destroy an office building with the office of the largest American news organization in the world. Will this possibly have some consequence to our international support for this operation? And there was no one there asking that question. There was no one there answering that question. And what happened? We bombed it on Shabbat, on Saturday, May 15th. That day was a turning point in the U.S. Support for Israel during the Gaza campaign. Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State, issued a condemnation of that bombing. And the White House did as well. Until then, Biden, Blinken, everyone were super supportive. That shifted public support. Shifted, by the way, in Canada as well. Right, the Trudeau government had been more supportive of Israel, and then that operation, I forget the name of the foreign minister, but that also led to a change in Canada's support, as well as other countries. Why were we not thinking about this? Why did it take us so long to get that information over to our allies to explain what we did? So my problem is, I don't think we're doing enough. I don't think we're doing the maximum effort that we could potentially do. And what we all need to understand is that, look, we all know Israel is embroiled in conflict, sadly, right? The saying by Golda Meir of, if they lay down their weapons, there will be peace. If we lay down our weapons, I'm paraphrasing here, we will no longer exist. Sadly, that is still very true. And we need a strong army and a strong country to counter these threats, the likes of which we just saw the other day with the Iranian suicide drone attacking a ship in the Gulf of Oman, killing a British national and a Romanian national, but looking to attack Israel. We know the extent of these threats and we have to be prepared. But the nature of conflict today is that these wars are fought on three different fronts. There's the battlefield, whether it's Gaza, Syria, Lebanon, Iran, wherever the soldiers are fighting. There's the home front, because our enemies look at our weak spot, our vulnerability is our citizens. So they fire off rockets into our cities to try to kill and injure and destroy. And thankfully for that, we have Iron Dome. For the battlefield, we have the sophisticated, advanced, moral IDF. But what about the third front, which is the public diplomacy front? That impacts other fronts. Like, imagine for a moment, if we didn't have Iron Dome and 4,000 rockets like those fired during that 10 days in May landed in Tel Aviv and in Ashkelon and in Sderot and all over the country, 4,000 rockets, you know how many people would be killed? Hundreds. Now imagine, what would the IDF have to do if hundreds of Israeli citizens are getting killed? I argue that the Iron Dome saves more Palestinian lives than it saves Israeli lives. Because if you had hundreds of Israelis being killed in Israel, Israel would have to do amazing destruction in the Gaza Strip, right? The public diplomacy front, if you're not managing that the right way, that undermines your war efforts, right? So we have to manage that, right? And if you're not going to do that right, you're going to undermine, and then you're going to get Biden on the phone who's going to say, okay, Bibi, wrap it up. Time to bring the troops home. End it. You can't say no to that. Right, so you got to be smart. Everything is connected, and right now we're not being smart.
I want to turn a little bit to your during your intervening years of journalism, when you took a break, or however you want to describe it, to become the senior policy advisor for the current prime minister, and if you can tell us a little bit from your working with him, to give a little insight into him as a person, as a prime minister, the chances of success of a long-term government, how he's going to manage all these disparate parties. We've seen some of the issues already arising, and your analysis of this government and how successful you believe it will be.
Well, first of all, I hope it lasts, right? Yesterday, the cabinet, the government approved the budget. We haven't had a state budget for 3 years. That has been detrimental for the state of Israel. This current budget has problems. I'm not happy with every aspect of it. But for example, an extra billion shekel to welfare services is extremely important. An extra 2 billion shekel to our health ministry is extremely important. We had an overcrowded health system before COVID. Kal vachomer now after COVID, right? Even more so. So we need and we needed a budget. Without a budget, you can't do any strategic long-term planning to provide the public with the services that a government is meant to provide. And that budget was held hostage by the former prime minister because it didn't serve him politically to pass a budget, right? If he had passed a budget, it would have meant that Benny Gantz would be transitioning and becoming prime minister this coming November, right? So he did not want that to happen and therefore brought down the prior government. So I'm hopeful. They still have a major hurdle ahead, which is to pass the budget in the Knesset in a vote in the parliament by the beginning of November. So let's hope that they're able to do that. That's good for the country and that's good for stability. We need, after four elections within the span of 2 years, we need some quiet, right? We need to be a normal country where we're not reading about these people all the time. We're not hearing about them all the time. Give us boring news about the weather, the traffic, right? You know, that's what we need. When I grew up in Chicago, there was a radio station called WBBM News Radio 78. It's still there. You get traffic and weather on the eights. That's what we need. Every 8 minutes, traffic and weather, you know? But more seriously, I think that if they pass the budget, what that basically means is that this government will not fall unless something ideological comes in its way, right? And then splinters it. You know, on paper, this government, I call it like the kaleidoscope government, because it really is made up of all the different colors and stripes and parties of that represent Israeli society, except unfortunately the Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox, are not part of this government. But you have the right and the left, and you have national religious, and you have secular. And you have, for the first time, the historic active participation of an Arab party in our coalition. That's huge. That's amazing, right? That's what we should always want. We should want to have the Arabs be active participants in how this country is run. They're 20% of our society, of our citizens. 10 million Israelis, 2 million of them are Arabs. We want them to play an active role. And until now, they've only been in the Knesset, and their whole agenda has only been fighting for the Palestinian cause. Okay, but what about the rampant violence in the Arab cities in Israel? What about the bad infrastructure, the poor education system, the high unemployment? What about the fact that they make up 20% of Israel, but 75%, I think, almost of homicides in this country? The hundreds of thousands of weapons that are illegally held by Arabs in this country. They have major problems that need to be dealt with, but because of politics, it hasn't been. This creates a unique opportunity. And by the way, violence in Arab cities doesn't just stay there. It spreads, right? We should want, like any country, you know, America, Canada, we all face the same challenge of how do we better integrate our minority. Israel too, we're a normal country. We have to deal with this challenge. So I think that's on paper, it's a beautiful idea. In practice, it's very complicated because you have such competing ideologies. You know, Meretz and Naftali Bennett's Yamina party look at the world very differently. By the way, not just on the Palestinians, on climate change, on the economy, on a range of social issues. But for now, everyone has recognized that they can agree on 70% of the issues and they're gonna disagree on 30%, but they're gonna try to focus on the 70. It's that 70-30 game. And we have to hope that they can, because that's what the people need, right? For too long, we focused on the 30 and let it divide us. We can focus on the 70 and work together. You know, I don't agree with Meretz. I don't agree with most of what Labor says. I also don't agree with everything that everyone says on the right. But I think that they're no less Israeli, or they're no less Zionist, and they're no less Jewish than I am. We can all find a way. There's common ground to connect us all. So I think that that's what this government seems to want, is trying to do. I hope that they can succeed at doing that with their eye on the prize, stability and the people of Israel, who deserve stability and prosperity. Naftali Bennett, just one word about him. I think he's a good guy, right? I had the opportunity to work with him for 2 years. So I've seen him as a politician. I've seen him in private. I think his heart is in the right place. He's extremely smart. He's very sharp. He is, he's fast. He's a fast decision maker. He's a fast learner. Does he have the same gravitas and experience that Benjamin Netanyahu has after 15 years in power? Of course not, right? No one does. But does that mean that no one else can be prime minister in the state of Israel? No, of course not. That's crazy, right? I mean, every country, every organization needs to renew itself with new blood, with a new fresh way of thinking about things. And I think that his heart is in the right place. So I hope that he succeeds, and I hope that he brings security and prosperity to the people of Israel.
Okay, you and your paper have developed a relationship with the UAE. You sponsored a number of conferences with the Khalij Times. You've been there once or twice, or I don't know how many times you've been there. Okay, so I wanted you to give us your insight into your experiences there, where you see the future of that. We saw a little bit of hiccup during the Gaza war in terms of some more critical statements about Israel. How do you see Israel continuing to navigate the Abraham Accords? Do you see other countries coming in, Oman, other Arab countries? And what was it on the ground and from some of the leaders that you've been meeting as well?
So first of all, I see definitely other countries will come in, right? But for that to happen, it needs to be a priority also for the Biden administration. And they will play a critical role in all of this in providing a benefit, right? That's added value to the relationship between the normalization, right? They're not just going to come because it's, you know, the right thing to do. Those relations are already taking place very much behind the scenes with Saudi, with Oman. We saw the prime minister of Israel, Netanyahu, fly to Oman a couple of years ago, right? In a historic visit. So we know that there are these relations. We know there's relations with the Qataris and with a lot more of these countries. But, you know, for those relations to be normalized, there's definitely needs to be a very active American role in all of this. And I don't yet necessarily see that. They say they would like to. So hopefully they'll come and they'll bring what they can bring to the table. The new government in Israel still finding its way will bring what it can bring to the table. And hopefully we'll be able to normalize some more of those relations. I think it's a huge pillar of stability for this region. And we definitely need to do all of that as we look to the future and the threat that the Iranians pose to all of us, right? Not just to Israel at all. The Khalij Times, which is in a Dubai-based newspaper, I reached out to them shortly after, about a year ago, just under a year ago, maybe a month after the Abraham Accords were announced and signed at the White House. And my interest was seeing that maybe we could develop some sort of relationship. And that led to a conference that kept on getting delayed and canceled because of Corona. We were lucky to hold it finally a couple months ago. And it was amazing. I mean, you know, honestly, it was moving. Me, and I said this, I took stage. I was one of the hosts. I was the host of the conference. And I took to the stage in Dubai, in the Burj Khalifa. This is the tallest building in the world in Dubai. And that's where we held the conference, in a hotel at the bottom of it. And I said, and I on stage with me was another journalist from the Khalij Times. And I said, you know, who would have believed less than a year ago that I, an Israeli Jewish journalist with a kippah on my head, would be standing here on a stage in Dubai, together next to me an Emirati journalist, and we'd be sitting in a room with Israelis and Emiratis and Bahrainis and Egyptians and Jordanians and all of us together holding a conference talking about Israeli UAE ties. Who would have believed that's possible? But it is. And that gives me hope. I think it should give all of us hope that there isn't a different way. That things can be different. And by the way, I think Netanyahu deserves tremendous, tremendous credit for bringing in those accords and normalizing those relationships. I mean, this is something that will change Israel for forever, right? You know, similar to what peace with the Egyptians did and peace with the Jordanians did. This is up there, and he really deserves a lot of credit for that.
Okay, a couple of quick, more little personal questions, and then we'll try to get quickly to some of the questions and comments before we wrap up. You've written a number of extremely important books on Iran, the whole Syrian nuclear strike by Israel, which is really reads like a thriller. There's amazing books for anybody who are not familiar. You should take a look at your books. How do you find the time to running such an important paper and doing the research on these books? Are you working on something else now? How do you coordinate all those activities?
So time is fluid, right? There's always more time if you believe that something is important. What I mean by that is when I was writing, I wrote one book before I became editor, and I had two books since I've been editor. I felt so passionate about the topics. I felt that they had to be written that I created the time. And it's not that I made the day longer. There's only 24 hours in a day, but it means I woke up earlier and I went to sleep later. And I just digressed less. I focused more I was able to sit and do it because I needed to do it, because I had this burning passion within me to do it. And that's how I've written my books, because I had felt this need. So if you're asking me if there's something new, I don't yet feel that. There's a lot of topics I'm playing with in my head. One of them is a little more advanced than others. And I'm looking to see that I feel that burning fire inside that will force me to find that time and not say, you know what, I got an hour now, I'll just watch a show on Netflix, right? Because I could do that. That's easy, right? It's much more difficult to sit down and focus and write and write and write and do more interviews and more research. That takes a lot. So it's not about the time. It's more about creating that time. But to create that time, for me at least, what has worked for me is to tap into this desire that I felt that I have to do this. I have to. So that's what's been my secret sauce.
You working on anything now?
So one thing that I've been working on, and I've started it with a series of long form articles, has been, you know, just going back to what we spoke about a little about Gaza before, is that I feel that there needs to be a story that tells the amazing journey that Israel has done from dropping one-ton bombs in places to take out a single terrorist, which is the way we used to do things back in 2000, 2001, to today being able to put a small, tiny missile through a window onto a bed to take out just the one guy who we want to take out. And I think that the world does not fully appreciate the extent that this country and this military goes to preserve the lives of its enemy and of civilians who are used as human shields by its enemy. I think that's a story that needs to be told. It's a very controversial story. It's not going to be a popular story for the world, because the world wants to keep us in that box as the war criminal, as the genocide executor. That's what they believe we are, right? And I think that we need to counter that with the truth, which is what I know and I see. And one amazing occurrence that you saw a number of times throughout the last operation in Gaza. And you can go back and find these videos, was you would see suddenly a video of a street in Gaza, nothing special, and just people walking around. And then suddenly a missile falls on a building and the building comes tumbling down. Now you gotta say to yourself, how did they know to film that building at that exact moment in time? And the reason is because Israel does this thing where it calls the building beforehand. It's called this knock on the roof tactic. And it lets the people know, listen, we're gonna bomb your building. You have to leave. By the way, they did that also with the AP office building. In a building with 12 stories, no one was killed, right? No one's injured, because they call and everyone evacuates. No one in the world does that. But then you have to say to yourself, there's another thing. Okay, so they know this building is gonna fall, but the people stand on the street not far away and film it. Now, I don't know about you, Murray, but if they called me and said, hey, the building next to you is going to be, or they call the building next to me and I find out in my home that the building next to me is gonna be bombed, I'm gonna get the hell out of here, because I don't know, maybe they'll miss, maybe it'll be a mistake, maybe there'll be collateral damage. But they stay there and they stand there filming because they know that the Israeli Air Force is only gonna hit that building. So they have no fear of staying on the street taking a video of it, right? I mean, that's incredible. Right? But they know that. Do we get credit for it? Not at all. None. This last operation in Gaza, the Israeli Air Force attacked over 1,000 targets, dropped over 1,000 munitions in Gaza. The death toll was about 260 people dead. Terrible. Any loss of life is terrible. Israel claims that a vast majority of them were militants, terrorists, armed men, gunmen, Hamas, Fatah, whatever. This is the most accurate military operation in the history of the world. The world should be standing and applauding the army and the state of Israel, applauding us. No one in the world could have done something like this in this densely populated area. No one, no one ever has done this. No one could have done this. We did it. Do we get credit for it? Nothing. That's a problem. So I feel that story should be told in a bigger, more comprehensive way. Not everything is positive. We've made mistakes over the time. The way we started was bad, but we learned the lessons and we implemented them to achieve this amazing success, which we still don't get credit for. So I feel that that's a story that could be told. Will it turn into a book? We'll find out. I don't know.
And if you mention that you lose your job as the head of UNRWA as well.
I don't think I'm in the running for that job.
Just saying, you know, that was...
Right, in fact, I did, exactly. The head of UNRWA, the head of UNRWA did.
Yeah.
And he and Hamas wanted his head for it. Yeah. Exactly.
So, by the way, Yaakov did write a great article. I told you about that. I mean, I commended you directly a few months ago. I think it was in the Jerusalem Post magazine. You can look it up on the whole Knock Knock. So hopefully we'll see that as one of the chapters in your upcoming book. All right, we can go on and on and on, but it's late. So I'm just going to turn quickly to the chat box. You want to look at it yourself, Yaakov, as well. There was a question about the issues of anti-Semitism, how you feel the various organizations are dealing with it now. There's a need to be a new initiative in combating anti-Semitism. You can answer quickly.
Which question was that?
There's a question of, do you believe that the current organizations dealing with anti-Semitism need a replacement? Do we need a new initiative to deal?
I think that, you know, I commend all these organizations. I think, you know, from Jewish Federations to Combating Anti-Semitism to the Simon Wiesenthal Center, ADL, we could go on and on and on. There's a lot of organizations out there, and there's a huge problem. I mean, there's no secret. You all know much better than I do living, I'm assuming in Canada or the United States, North America, the challenge that we're facing today. There's rampant anti-Semitism. It comes from the right. It comes from the left. We have to stand up against it. I think that the Jewish organizations are doing a good job, as good as they can. I think that some are being more diplomatic. Some are being more aggressive. But I don't have something that I can necessarily criticize. I think that everyone is trying to do what they believe to be the right thing.
Okay, there's another comment or question just about Israel. Israel is a variety of people, all types of colors, etc. At the same time, how does it continue to integrate the 20% full citizens who are Palestinian Arabs?
I mean, this is one of the big challenges for this government, right? Which is, how are they going to do that? They have the participation of the Ram Party by Mansour Abbas, who I've only heard good things about from members of the coalition who are working with him. And he, you know, you mentioned the Gaza operation before, and you know, so the Khalij Times, for example, that was a week before our conference. They stood through with it, and they still held the conference. Mansour Abbas could have pulled out of the coalition talks, but he stuck through it too. Right. And that shows his sincerity and his desire to try to change things for his people. Of course, he has a political interest, which is to advance politically and to become the de facto leader of the Israeli Arabs. But there is a need to invest money. There's a need to fight crime. I think if you talk to Arabs today, which I do, they want to eradicate crime. They want to improve their quality of life. They want to feel part and parcel of this country. But do we have discrimination still of Arabs? Of course we do. By the way, we have discrimination of Haredim in this country too. We have to figure that out as well, right? We have challenges. We're 73 years old. We're imperfect, right? Anyone who'll tell you otherwise is lying. But I mean, you know, you look at a country like America, which has been around for hundreds of years, almost, not yet 300, but almost, is a country that, look at what they had a few months ago with Black Lives Matters and riots and protests. And the challenges that they're facing in terms of integrating minorities into civil society, into government, into, you know, just general what's happening in that country. We're no different. Why would we? But we're always being held to this double standard. So I think that we have to do what's right by the Arabs, because it's the right thing, not just for them, but also for us. It's the right thing for this country to move forward.
Okay, there are a couple other comments and questions, but it's late, and it's late in Israel also. So we really want to thank you for this fascinating discussion, and we can see that there's a lot more to discuss. We'll continue to read your views in the Jerusalem Post, and we should continue to discuss. So thank you very much.
It was great to be with all of you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Take care.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Maury, for the wonderful interview, and thank you, Yaakov Katz. Really a pleasure, and very fascinating and interesting, and you have an important role to play, any editor of a newspaper, but especially, as you mentioned, the Jerusalem Post punches above its weight, and We look forward to seeing your writing. I read many of your articles and I look at the post every day, and let's continue. Let's hope some of the issues you've raised do get addressed. And thank you. Thank you, Arit. Thank you, Maury. And we look forward, everybody, to learning with, you know, back to our regular series of Shirim tomorrow, 1 p.m., you know, Simi Piris and Yirmiyahu, the Torah of the Week with Moshe Sokolov tomorrow night. And we're putting to final touches on our Elo program that we will send out soon. We'll get posted on the website. So we look forward to learning from you. We look forward to our next Kedma conversation. So everybody have a wonderful day. Good afternoon and Erev Tov, Laila Tov in Israel.
Thank you.
Yes.
What was the name of the Jerusalem Post before it became Jerusalem Post?
The Palestine Post, of course, before Israel was known as the Palestine Post. And, yeah, who,
and who founded it?
I forget Agron. Now. The guy from
Agron.
Agron, right.
Very good. Who answered that? Very good.
I did, but okay, it's okay.
Okay, everybody have a wonderful day. Invite your friends. I'm sorry?
One more thing. The place of Englewood, where Zyf is, much nicer house than mine.
Okay. All right. Be well, everybody. Thank you.
Okay. Take care.
Thank you. Bye. Bye-bye.